Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains June 13th through the 23rd. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip. When it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild, like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Karen Reed.
Day 7 of the Karen Reed trial. That would be the 30th of April 2025, if anyone's playing along at home and wants the exact date. It opened with one of the most highly anticipated witnesses so far. Jennifer McCabe, not a police officer, not a forensic expert, just a friend of Karen Reed, a friend of John O'Keefe, and someone who was standing just feet away when his body was found in the snow outside 34 Fairview Road. On direct examination, Assistant District Attorney Hank Brennan got right to the heart of why she was on the stand. Jennifer was with Karen and Carrie Roberts that morning. She was there when they circled back to the Elbert house around 5 a.m. looking for John. She was there when they saw what looked like a human figure in the snow. Well, Karen did. And according to Jennifer, she was there when Karen started screaming, "I hit him, I hit him, I hit him." So lots to unpack in today's testimony of Jennifer McCabe on cross. Love to hear your thoughts in the comment section. Please do that as the story rolls along. If you have any thoughts that you want to share, and please press subscribe wherever you're listening to us. If you're on the podcast platforms, press subscribe there. And if you're on YouTube, please press subscribe as well, so you don't miss any of the cases that we cover for you right here. Okay, let's get into it. She said it clearly, no hesitation. McCabe told the jury she remembers Karen repeating that phrase. And she ran towards the snow-covered figure. Brennan said, her now certain, or how certain she was. She answered 100% that she heard Karen Reed say, "I hit him, I hit him, I hit him." Jennifer said she ran into the house to wake her sister Nicole Elbert and Nicole's husband Brian. Surveillance video corroborates part of this. The porch lights come on at the time she says she entered. She didn't see the Elberts at that point, just turned the lights on and yelled upstairs. Brennan then played the 911 call McCabe made moments later. The jury listened as Jennifer's voice came through. Frantic, saying there was a man in the snow. In the background, someone screams, "John." It's hard to tell who's saying what, but the panic is clear. Brennan asked her to describe the scene in her own words, and McCabe said it was chaos. Next came the issue of the Google search, arguably one of the most picked-apart pieces of this case. McCabe acknowledged that she searched the phrase, "How's long to die in cold," on her phone. She said she did it because Karen asked her to look it up, that sort of information about hypothermia. According to her, it happened in the heat of the moment, while they were trying to understand what was happening to John. But here's where controversy kicks in. That search was logged as 2:27 a.m. Okay? That's what one of the logs says. But what does the log mean? That's where they had an expert come in. So 2:27 a.m., roughly 2.5 hours before they discovered John's body. Brennan addressed the timestamp issue head on. He didn't present a definitive explanation, but suggested one possibility. The browser tab may have already been open, and the timestamp could reflect when the tab was first opened, not when the search was typed. Jennifer didn't get into technical detail. She simply said, Karen asked me to search it, so I did. Later in the day, on January 29th, Jennifer said more memories came back to her, specifically the I hit him comment. And Karen mentioning her taillight at that moment in time, that it was broken. McCabe testified that she had called Canton Police Sergeant Michael Lank unprompted to share those details, saying she felt they were important to the investigation. The Commonwealth used this to support that idea that she was trying to assist, not withhold. Then came the emotional part of her testimony. Brennan asked her about the impact this had on her, and Jennifer, visibly shaken, described how traumatic that morning was, seeing John in the snow, listening to Karen scream. She teared up as she talked about it. And it didn't feel rehearsed. She paused at times, tried to collect herself, told the jury, this wasn't something you ever forget. That was the focus of the prosecution's direct exam, not to prove the entire case through one witness, but to build a credible timeline from someone who was there and to establish that if the jury believes Jennifer, Karen Reed made a spontaneous incriminating statement right there at the scene. Importantly, there was no claims made by McCabe during direct examination that conflicted with prior statements in open court. Some of those issues, like what she did or didn't say to the grand jury, would come up later during cross. But on direct, what we heard was her real-time experience, what she saw, what she heard, and what she did next. She wasn't claiming to have solved the crime. She wasn't pointing fingers at other people either. She told the jury she didn't see John earlier in the night. She said she didn't notice a body when she peeked out to check for Karen's car before 5 a.m. She didn't claim to have all the answers. But she did claim one thing with clarity, that Karen Reed, standing feet from John O'Keefe's body, screamed, I hit him. Whether that statement was guilt, confusion, or shock, she left that to the jury. By the time the court recessed for lunch, McCabe had given the Commonwealth something they badly needed, a clean, firsthand narrative of what happened in the minutes before first responders arrived. And for now, she did it without contradiction or collapse. Of course, that would change in the afternoon because the defense, they were just getting started. After lunch, the energy in the courtroom shifted. Gone was the emotional, controlled pacing of the prosecution's direct. In its place, defense attorney Alan Jackson, aggressive, theatrical, and walking into the room like he'd been waiting for this moment all trial. Jennifer McCabe, still on the stand, braced herself as the tone turned sharply confrontational. Jackson opened by going straight for the heart of her testimony, the I hit him statement. The three words McCabe said Karen Reed screamed upon discovering John O'Keefe's in the snow. But Jackson wasn't interested in what she said that morning. He wanted to know why, in her April 2022 grand jury testimony, she never mentioned it. He pulled out the transcript. He quoted her own words back to her, where she recalled Karen maybe saying things like, what if I hit him, or did I hit him? But not the clear, repeated, I hit him phrasing. McCabe didn't dispute the omission. She acknowledged she hadn't phrased it that way to the grand jury, but she didn't back off her memory either. She said she remembered the moment with absolute clarity and insisted the quote was real. There are certain things I will never forget, she said flatly. That's what she said. I'm 100% sure. Jackson didn't let up. If she was that certain now, why wasn't she then? Why change it now? Why evolve the quote into something far more incriminating? It was one of his sharper points, and the first crack to the defense tried to wedge into McCabe's reliability. From there, things escalated rather quickly. Jackson pivoted to January 2023 when federal agents, part of a separate investigation into the case, showed up at Jennifer's home unannounced. And here's where things got awkward. McCabe admitted she initially gave the agents a false name, telling them that she was her sister, Nicole Elbert. She didn't deny it. She said she had just dropped off her kids at school and panicked when two men in plain clothes approached her at home. She asked them to wait, went inside, and made a series of phone calls before returning to talk. Yeah, that makes a little bit of sense now, doesn't it? Men in plain clothes wanting to talk, and you're in law enforcement, and, you know, she's not, but her husband is, and there may be people who don't like law enforcement in the neighborhood or somewhere, and they're showing up at your house, maybe pretending to be cops. Yeah, I can see why. Let me just verify this first. I don't know why you give out your own sister's name, but in the heat of the moment, maybe that's all you're coming up with. Anyway, now Jackson had the phone records. He walked through the list during that short window McCabe that had called. Her husband, Carrie Roberts, and a victim advocate with the DA's office, John O'Keefe's mother, and Brian Elbert. But when those federal agents first asked if she'd contacted anyone other than her husband and Robert, she told them no. That was the moment Jackson pounced on. He bluntly said, "Was that a lie?" McCabe admitted it wasn't accurate. She had, in fact, called more people, but she said it wasn't some attempt to mislead. It was a mistake made in a stressful moment. She clarified later and gave them the full list. "I wasn't trying to hide anything," she said. "I wasn't prepared for that interview. I didn't even brush my teeth." Jackson wasn't interested in stress. He was building a pattern. First the false name, then the incomplete answers. He asked whether she contacted Carrie Roberts to get your story straight. McCabe flatly denied it. She said they often gave each other a heads up when media or law enforcement came calling, not to coordinate lies, but because they were both under the same public pressure. "We're not used to this," she said. "We're just normal moms." Jackson, of course, rolled his eyes. The jury watched closely, and next came a barrage of questions about what McCabe saw or didn't see earlier that night. When she briefly stepped outside the house to look for Karen's SUV before 5 a.m., she says she saw Reed's black Lexus parked out front. Jackson asked, "Did you see a body in the yard?" "No," McCabe replied. "I wasn't looking for one." Followed up, But it would have been in the same area you were looking," he said. "I didn't look at the snow," she said. "I was looking at the road." Jackson tried to corner her into saying that John's body wasn't there at that point, or at least that she should have seen it. But she didn't take the bait. She stuck with what she saw and what she didn't. He moved to when they left the Elbert home and drove back toward McCabe's house. "Did you see anything in the yard as you pulled away again?" She said no. She had turned towards the back seat, focused on her daughter. Then came the moment that's been circulating online for months, the dog. Jackson brought up Chloe, the German Shepherd owned by the Elberts, which the defense has long floated as a possible source of O'Keefe's injuries. He asked if McCabe remembered seeing or hearing the dog when she went inside that morning. "I don't remember," she said. Jackson pushed harder. "Wasn't it strange that a big territorial dog didn't bark when strangers were on the property?" McCabe repeated she didn't recall the dog's behavior. Not that the dog wasn't there, but that she had no memory of Chloe in that moment. Jackson implied maybe the dog had already been removed, that someone knew something had happened and whisked the dog away. John O'Keefe's injuries are not, death injuries are not from a dog. Anyway, it was one of the more speculative angles of this questioning, and McCabe didn't entertain it. She just repeated, "I wasn't looking for the dog. I don't remember." From there, Jackson dug into the interaction between McCabe and another party guest, Julie Nagel. According to testimony, McCabe had asked Julie for a screenshot of a text she received from her brother around midnight, the night of the party. McCabe said she was trying to piece together a timeline and asked for it for context. Jackson framed it as something more. "Another example of witnesses aligning stories." McCabe denied it. She said she wasn't even sure if she gave that screenshot to police. She just wanted to make sense of the night, which anyone would. This back and forth between Jackson and McCabe kept getting sharper. He talked over her at times. She grew defensive, interrupting back. At one point, she raised her voice to explain why she was flustered during her interview with federal agents. Judge Beverly Cannone stepped in a few times to cool things off, reminding them both not to talk over one another. The tension was thick. But here's the thing. McCabe didn't fold. She didn't recant. She didn't walk back any of her core testimony. Even when Jackson pulled transcripts and poked at gaps, she acknowledged what she'd said and then what she was saying now, and let the jury decide whether inconsistencies even really mattered. And by the end of the day, the cross wasn't finished. Jackson told the judge he at least had 2 more hours of questioning left. The jury was dismissed for the day. McCabe stepped down for now. The prosecution's morning strategy was to show an emotionally raw, honest witness. The defense afternoon goal was to paint her as forgetful, manipulated, or manipulative. But even with all the pressure, McCabe stuck to her account. And she didn't flinch on what she says she heard. I hit him. Court wrapped early. But if you were in the building, you know the day was not over yet. Once the jury was dismissed and Jennifer McCabe's cross was paused until Friday, the real behind-the-scenes maneuvering started, the kind that never makes the headlines but often decides what jurors get to see and, more importantly, what they don't. Right after the jury left, Judge Beverly Cannone called both sides to the table for a hearing on expert witnesses, specifically the crash reconstruction experts from the firm ARCA. These are the same experts who were involved in an earlier federal review of the case and had testified in Karen Reed's first trial. The issue now was whether they'd be allowed to testify again in this one and whether either side had played fast and loose with the evidence disclosures. Let's be honest, this wasn't just about who could testify. This was about how much patience Judge Cannone had left. What started as a procedural discussion turned into a pretty clear rebuke of both teams. The judge was visibly frustrated. She called out repeated and deliberate violations of reciprocal discovery obligations, meaning neither the prosecution nor the defense had fully or promptly shared the expert materials they were supposed to. Robert's analysis, digital files, stuff that under Massachusetts law, both sides are required to hand over in advance so everyone can prepare. That didn't happen. Cannone didn't name names. She didn't raise her voice, but her tone, cold and sharp. She told both sides, and I'm paraphrasing here, cut the games, no more nonsense, let's just try this case. Then came the ruling. The ARCA experts can testify, both of them. That was a win for the prosecution, but it didn't feel like a celebration. It came with a warning. If either side failed to comply moving forward, sanctions were on the table, and the judge made it clear she'd had enough of the procedural stalling and trial by ambush tactics that were starting to eat away at the courtroom. Now, backing up a bit, earlier that morning, before McCabe even resumed her testimony, there had been an unusual moment. Court was unexpectedly closed to the public for about 20 minutes. Reporters were asked to step out, doors shut, no live stream. Inside, Judge Cannone held a private in-chambers meeting with the attorneys, Karen Reed, and members of her family. No one knows exactly what was discussed. No transcript, no leaks, but timing-wise, it likely had something to do with the expert witnesses' dispute or with testimony scheduling, especially given how testy the discovery fight has become. So when the jury was hearing emotional testimony from Jennifer McCabe, all of this was bubbling beneath the surface. Withheld reports, missed deadlines, and an increasingly impatient judge trying to keep both sides from derailing the process. But that wasn't the only drama of the day. While Reed's attorneys were still inside arguing over expert witnesses, she walked out of the courtroom and headed straight for the waiting cameras, as she always does, and she didn't hold back. Karen Reed gave a brief, unscripted statement to reporters outside the courthouse. She called Jennifer McCabe's testimony perjury, outright, not vague, not subtle. Another instance of perjury, she said. She also addressed a 2:27 a.m. Google search head-on, saying, "I did not tell Jen to make a Google search. I certainly didn't tell her to make the one at 2:27 either." Karen's a funny one. She wasn't shouting, but she was clearly angry. Direct, the subtext was clear. She sees the entire trial as a railroad job, and she's no longer interested in staying quiet about it. Of course, none of this was said in front of the jury. That's important. They're instructed to avoid all media. In a case this charge, comments like that still ripple. And if you believe every jury member is not seeing media, I got news for you. And while all of that was unfolding inside the was folding inside and outside the courthouse, just down the hall, a whole different hearing was happening. That's been casting a shadow over this case for months. The one with the blogger, the local blogger who's inserted himself deep into the Reed defense camp. He was in court for a bail violation hearing. He's facing criminal charges tied to allegations of witness intimidation, including harassing and doxing individuals, connected to the case. It isn't speculation. He's been indicted. The court has the receipts. Prosecution played video clips from his social media posts, including one where he said that if Massachusetts State Police Lieutenant Brian Tully, a lead investigator in the Reed case, were burned alive in the most painful way possible, he would be so happy. He also mentioned if his family was in the house, too, he'd be so happy. You know, like a real journalist does. You go on the air and you start going after the police officers or anybody that you don't like and telling that you'd be happy if they burned alive in their home with their family. Is this the kind of guy you folks want to be following? Would you be happy if this man and his family burned alive in their home? Those are the words of a very unhealthy brain. I'm not going to call him names, the blogger names, or anything, but unhealthy. And if you haven't realized that by now, you better. Because it's getting into dangerous. I mean, it already has been in dangerous territory. Nobody seemed to have seen this, at least over there. You're talking about a dangerous human being who is not okay. He needs mental health help. And it's sad and it's scary because he has a family too. And I hope those people are safe. Even as vile as I think some of the things that he said are, I would never wish him and his family to be burned alive in their home. No, my response would be, I hope he gets the help he needs. I like the digging into things and questioning and challenging authority. But the way it's being done, the vile, vile way it's being done, it's not okay. Well, he's just saying that. He's never going to do it. Yeah, he probably wouldn't. But you know what? The loose cannons, some of them that follow him, probably would. And you don't know how loose all those cannons are out there. Some are just into it. Some are like looking for a way to end it. That's why words can be very dangerous when you say things like that. I'd be questioning myself if I was still on that side. You can certainly support Karen Reed without being part of all that. And a lot of people are. And there's nothing wrong with that. I think you can also support Karen Reed's bid for freedom without believing any of the story, any of the dog in the house story. I don't think that even has anything to do with anything. I don't think it exists. But you can still believe that she didn't hit him or have reasonable doubt about it. Where it's just too gray of an area to really know. Without being way the hell over there with the guy that's calling for people to be burned alive in their homes. I know he's not asking someone to do it, but he's saying he'd be very happy. And that's where you get the lunatic out there that's going to go, I want to do that for him. I'm going to show him how much I'm aligned to him and how my allegiance is there. You have people that think that way. Why? Because they're not well either. You got unhealthy, playing to a crowd of many who are unhealthy. I'm not going to say everyone, but I'm going to say a lot. And all it takes is one that's really unhealthy to do horrible things. Is that who you want to be behind? Is that who you want to have as your, as he calls himself, journalism Jesus? I hope he gets the help he needs, because that ain't healthy. The courtroom, according to reporters inside, was stunned. The judge didn't shout, but her message was crystal clear. The blogger was on thin ice, and Commonwealth argued that he had violated conditions of his release and was continuing to create a threatening atmosphere for witnesses and law enforcement. But in the end, the judge did not revoke his bail, not yet. She warned him and his counsel that any further outburst, posts, or intimidation would likely land him behind bars. Maybe that's what he needs. Some time where he can't do all this, where he's forced to just be, make some peace with the anger that flows inside him, and dial back to what's important in your life. He talks about it all the time, his kids, and they should be. But there's an unhealthy brain going on right now, and that needs to be taken care of before anything else can happen. So again, not going to say anything horrible. Not going to call him names. Unhealthy brain. I hope you get the help you need. I really do. Your kids deserve it. Your family deserves it. Who cares about everything else out here in the atmosphere? You got to worry about your health, because it's not good. Now, you can debate whether Kearney is doing journalism, activism, or harassment, but in the eyes of the court, that line is getting dangerously thin, and it's hard to ignore how much that kind of outside noise is bleeding into the trial itself. And here's the reality. The case is no longer just about facts. It's become a battleground of narratives inside and outside the courtroom. You got one side focused on timelines, evidence, and witness testimony. The other side is rallying behind slogans, blog posts, and live stream clips. There are protesters outside with signs, comment sections full of conspiracy theories, TikTokers picketing and picking apart facial expressions like it's a reality show. And somewhere in the middle, a man is dead. John O'Keefe hasn't testified. He never will. But what happens in this courtroom? What gets in front of the jury? What doesn't? Who plays by the rules and who doesn't? That's what's going to shape the ending of the story. And this day, April 30th, wasn't just about a witness. It was about the pressure building behind every witness, a judge laying down lines that can't be crossed, a defendant talking directly to the public, and a sideshow in a separate courtroom that reminds everyone just how far off the rails this thing could still go. Your thoughts in the comment section. Would love to see them. We're going to start doing some lives here pretty soon, too, so that will be fun. And we can do some more of this in real time. Okay, press subscribe wherever you download podcasts, if that's where you're listening to us. And hey, be sure to check out our YouTube channel if you're there already. Thank you. Hi. Thank you for watching this. Please press subscribe down there so you don't miss any of our coverage on any of this stuff. We greatly appreciate that. My name is Tony Brewski. And I have a feeling we will be talking again very soon.
Want to stay on top of the latest true crime cases? Press subscribe now and never miss a breaking update from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. In a world where the darkest secrets lie just beneath the surface.
Well, they said it was an accident, but the evidence says otherwise.
Where hidden killers roam unnoticed. In the shadows.
I think you would definitely be looking at a blend of toxic, very bad narcissistic personality traits, and they will be vengeful and possibly resort to violence.
Join Tony Brewski as he uncovers the truth behind the most chilling cases.
They said it was an accident, but the evidence clearly says otherwise.
Each episode, we dig deep into the minds of those who commit the unthinkable.
To your point on narcissism, he thinks in his own mind how witty he is.
Yeah.
But he lost that jury. I was done with him in 2 minutes.
From unsolved mysteries to infamous crimes.
Geez, you've just talked about how you've taught yourself how to do everything under the sun. I bet you did a YouTube video, how to best kill somebody with a knife.
Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi takes you where few dare to go.
How does someone with such a dark secret go unnoticed for so long?
With multiple new episodes every single day.
We're not just telling stories, we're seeking justice.
Listen now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.